Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette today on January 7th, Wednesday, 2026. Hope you're having a good day so far. Today on the front page is a large and colorful picture of an American Eagle plane arriving Monday at the University of Illinois Willard Airport in Savoy. Airport officials haven't given up on trying to attract carriers willing to add routes from the facility to Washington, D.C. or other destinations. And we'll start there with the article about the University of Illinois Willard Airport with the heading, Yet to Land Deal. Officials on talks with multiple carriers. It does take time to secure new routes, by Jana Wiersema. Roughly 2 years after Willard Airport announced an incentive aimed at attracting leisure service to a new destination, Chicago and Dallas-Fort Worth remain the only direct options for passengers flying out of the facility. However, Airport Director Tim Bannon said that the University of Illinois-owned airport continues to talk with carriers about adding new routes. The overall sentiment of the industry is positive. I think at this time, he said, we're having some wonderful conversations with multiple carriers. However, it does take time to secure new routes, and we're continuing to work on that. With the help of community partners and private donors, the airport has raised about $850,000 for a minimum revenue guarantee for direct service to any airport in Florida, Arizona, or Las Vegas. This includes $500,000 from the U of I, which could alternatively be used to offset ground handling fees if a carrier so desires, Bannon said. The airport also continues to offer a separate minimum revenue guarantee of nearly $2 million for direct service to Washington, D.C. Bannon believes that Willard's market is attractive to many carriers, though he added that the airport is always competing with facilities throughout the country. He estimated that the average incentive offered for a leisure route is just under $2 million, though he feels that $1 million, Willard's initial goal for the incentive, is still somewhat competitive. It's a nice round number, seven figures, and with a good business case would be attractive to the right carrier, Bannon said. $1.5 million is certainly much more competitive and gets us pretty close to the average incentive that airlines are accepting today, nationally, but $2 million would really be strong. It depends on the business case, the air carrier, and the amount of incentives available. It's somewhat of a package deal. He added that it is extremely expensive for airlines to start offering new routes due to not only risk, but also high operating costs for the aircraft. Willard officials spoke with multiple carriers about its Washington, D.C. and leisure incentives during the takeoff North America 2025 conference in Tallahassee, Florida, this past November, Bannon said. I think the industry strategy, depending on the carrier's goals, those are constantly changing, he said. So we have to really understand the goals of each airline, where they're expanding, what routes they may be interested in, and position our airport to fight for those routes. When it comes to current flights in and out of Willard, passengers have doubtless noticed that the downward escalator is out of service again. Bannon said that this has been the case for a couple of months now. While the authorization has been issued for repairs to the tune of $24,000, parts are still on order, and he doesn't have a definite timeline for how soon the escalator could be up and running again. However, we expect the escalator to be back operational here in the next 60 days, I would guess, or sooner, he said. Bannon added that both escalators, which are original to the terminal building, was constructed in 1988, and they are set to be replaced as part of the upcoming renovations, likely due in late 2027 or 2028. And there's a picture of those escalators with the Do Not Enter sign constructed to keep people from riding on them. Continuing on the front page at the bottom, an article from the Urbana City Council with the heading, Alderwoman Resigning Due to Impending Move. A replacement will serve out Colasetti's term through 2029, by Luke Taylor. The City Council will be looking for a new member with the upcoming resignation of Ward 4 Alderwoman Jaya Colasetti. Colasetti has been in the seat since being elected in 2021. She was re-elected unopposed last year. "It's such an incredible privilege to represent Ward 4," she said. "It's been an incredible honor to work with the folks who are up here in this particular leadership team." "It was a difficult decision," Colasetti said during the announcement of her resignation at this week's council meeting, "but her family will be moving out of that ward, making her ineligible for the current role." "The February 2nd meeting will be her last," she said, "so there is still about a month before someone will need to be appointed to finish out the term, which runs through 2029. She will remain in the city's Alternative Response Task Force and intends to find other ways to stay involved in local government because she isn't leaving Urbana, only moving over to Ward 7, represented by Alderman James Quisenberry. "It's going to be a big change, but we're still here in Urbana," Colasetti said. "I love this city." Quisenberry welcomed her to his ward. Mayor Deshaun Williams, who has only been in his own seat for a few months, said it was an honor to work together for that brief window. "Thank you for having a high-level approach to any and everything that we've provided and brought moving forward. Thank you for believing my little crazy visions, right?" Williams said, "as we continue to work together to move the city forward. Your work has not gone unnoticed." Ward number 1 Alderman Mary Alice Wu said, "It was a pleasure to serve with Colasetti, and she will be missed. I've always felt that you sought to find a way to compromise, to have as many voices being heard, being addressed, and I've really appreciated that as we try and really do the best for our entire city," Wu said. Tuesday's council meeting also included approval of a resolution to authorize an agreement for the city to provide $37,000 in funding for daytime staffing at the Cunningham Township Overnight Shelter. Currently, funding will help the shelter stay open on days when temperatures drop below the 20 degrees mark. But according to documents provided to the council, the ongoing goal is to open daily in order for staff to provide physical and mental health assessments and case management to prepare people ahead of the shelter's closure at the end of April. According to an agreement also approved at the meeting, the township will provide updates and reviews of the shelter's operations and repay any unspent funds at the end of that time period. Police surveillance technology is also back on the council's agenda, as many residents have long expressed concerns about its use, but discussion was delayed until future meetings. While an ordinance established approval policy and reporting requirements for surveillance technology was up for a study session alongside some supplemental information, the council elected to wait until representatives of the Urbana Police Department were available to present information on their technology. Additionally, representatives of Placer AI will likely speak at an upcoming meeting. Urbana's Community Development Department currently makes use of Placer's product, which uses anonymized cell phone data with location data provided by apps where users have to opt in to allow location services. Also on the front page, a special section with the heading, "As Heard on WDWS News Gazette Radio," airing from 4 to 5 p.m. Monday through Thursday on WDWS 1400 AM and streaming online at newsgazette.com. Episode 2, which is the just before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, Stevens Family YMCA CEO Jeff Scott felt like it was high time to expand. That was nearly 6 years and 700 plus additional family memberships ago. There's a lot of families that tell us it's just too crowded. "We love everything about the Y, but it's too much," Scott said Tuesday on NG Radio. "Kids are on waiting lists and miss out on opportunities all the time because we don't have the space." While they're still a little ways away from hammering out a timeline, the approximately 50,000 square foot expansion project is a go. $20,000 for Carl to provide therapy, rehab, and wellness services, $30,000 for the Y, bringing a track that will double in size, new look fitness space, more youth and teen areas, and outdoor play space, among other things. No additional water at this time. A lot of people ask about that. It's just a really difficult thing to add on, but lots of different things going on, Scott said, of a facility that now has 5,500 family memberships and more than 14,000 members. Coming to downtown Champaign in 2026, Chop House on Main, which plans to open in the former Guido space sometime this spring. And coming in 2027 and 2028, a long-awaited hotel and expanded downtown plaza, which Champaign Mayor Deb Finan discussed on Tuesday's show. We have heard particularly from our wedding venues that having additional hotel space downtown would be helpful. And just from an events perspective, Finan said of the Doug Altenberger-developed collegiate-themed Graduate by Hilton, scheduled for fall 2027 opening at the northwest corner of Hill and Neal. Work will begin this summer on phase two of the plaza project, which involves repurposing what's now a large parking lot along Neal Street. We will lose some parking spaces. I know that that's caused some consternation, but it will allow expansion of the plaza, Finan said. We're looking at some more space for kid-friendly and family-friendly activities and just being able to host bigger events. Through the first 11 months of 2025, 7,907 went into the 6 video gaming machines at Champaign's Mach 1 and 6,168,000 came out, all but ensuring with the convenience store of retaining its unofficial title as the area establishment where the most money was wagered. A sure bet for number 2, the 10-terminal Mach 1 in Tilton, where, with 1 month of receipts still to be tabulated, over $7 million has gone in, and $5,643,000 has come out in 2025. Moving on to Section A5, still under our communities, we have an article here from the Capitol, Capitol News Illinois, with the heading, "Not a priority. House Speaker calls Bears Stadium ask insensitive amid budget pressures. Franchise threatens to move to Indiana if lawmakers don't lend a hand," by Ben Zielinski. Illinois House Speaker Emmanuel Chris Welsh said he is hopeful about the Chicago Bears' prospect of victory over the Green Bay Packers in their playoff game on Saturday. But he likely didn't instill any hope in team officials who are seeking state resources to build a new stadium in Arlington Heights. "When folks say, what's your priority going into the legislative session, we're trying to bring down the cost of living," Welsh said at a City Club of Chicago event on Tuesday, talking about a brand new Bears stadium when this one's not even 25 years old. "That's insensitive to what real people are going through right now." Welch was addressing questions about the Bears' request for property tax breaks and more than $800 million in state support for infrastructure upgrades. Bears President Kevin Warren claimed in a letter to fans last month that the team, which Forbes valued at $8.2 billion, was told directly by state leadership, "Our project will not be a priority in 2026. Welch, a Democrat from West Suburban Hillside, did not dispute the claim. The Bears' current home, Chicago Park District-owned Soldier Field, was rebuilt with state money in 2002. Warren said the Bears say their new project should be a priority for state lawmakers seeking to create jobs and build state economy. Governor J.B. Pritzker said he is open to allocating state funds for infrastructure upgrades to accommodate crowds near the former Arlington Park Racecourse, the team-owned potential development site. But he's so far declined to support direct tax breaks or financial aid for team facilities. After being shafted by the General Assembly for several years, Warren threatened to explore building the stadium in Northwest Indiana. That excited Indiana Republican Governor Mike Braun, who said he will work with the team. Some suburban Democrats support helping the Bears relocate to Arlington Heights, but the team faces a math problem in the legislature. 28 of the 78 House Democrats live in Chicago, and several of them have expressed opposition to the team moving out of the city. Welsh has adopted a rule for the House Democratic Caucus that at least 60 Democrats must support a bill to allow it to move forward. Senate President Don Harmon, a Democrat from Oak Park, isn't prioritizing the Bears in the Senate either. President Harmon agrees that we need to stay focused on issues like education and health care and everyday affordability, the things that people care about, especially given the economic uncertainties being thrown at us by Washington, Harmon spokesperson John Patterson said in an email. And a budget situation. Another hindrance for the Bears is the state budget. Pritzker told lawmakers last year during his annual budget address that there was little room for new spending, and any lawmaker that wanted money for a new program would have to come up with a corresponding cut. The fiscal year 2026 budget ultimately increased spending in most areas by less than 1% from the previous year. State lawmakers will return to Springfield next year to begin the spring legislative session, and the budget picture remains murky. The governor's budget office announced in the fall that the state was on track to run a $2.2 billion in fiscal year in 2027, which begins on July 1st. Amid that landscape, Welsh said, members of this caucus, his caucus, are not hearing from their constituents about the Bears. They're hearing people talk about the cost of prescription drugs, about premiums of their health insurance going up, grocery prices, rent. They're talking about the cost of living, Welsh said. I don't know anyone that has knocked on a door and someone has said anything about the Chicago Bears. No state leader, including Welsh, on Tuesday has explicitly ruled out addressing the Bears' concerns this year, but the speaker, who is entering his sixth year leading the House, said this session will be all about affordability. Other lawmakers who have chastised the Bears for seeking public money said the state should have other priorities, such as increasing funding for public education and social services. New budget report. While there's still 6 months to go in the fiscal year, a report published Tuesday by the Independent Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability painted a rosier picture of state finances, at least in the short term. It found state revenue is up nearly 5%, or $1.2 billion, through the first 6 months of fiscal year 2026, compared to the same period in FY 2025. That includes state tax revenue up 1%, an indicator of consumer confidence in the economy. Pritzker is scheduled to present his FY27 budget proposal on February 18th, which will include new estimates from his office about revenue projects for current year and a plan to close next year's projected deficit. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service. And there's some news from Danville about its Village Mall, Bath & Body Works' the latest store to close. Another store has announced it's leaving the Village Mall. As Danville Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. gave a mall update to aldermen at Tuesday night's Danville City Council meeting, he said he just learned that Bath & Body Works will be closing on January 24th. The announcement follows reports that Dunham Sports, also at the Village Mall, plans to close on Monday. Williams said the mall owners have stopped communicating with the city and they don't respond to messages. He said they've not been paying taxes on the Interior Corridor Mall property, which is in addition to the Slumberland-owned property that also houses Shoe Sensation and the front area from County Market to Ross Dress for Less. City officials and the community are now waiting to hear about the auction later this month of the Interior Corridor Mall property that has a starting bid of $700,000. That property sold for $470,000 last year. Williams, too, said that what's frustrating about this is the city also put our best foot forward and offered incentives. And there are letters of intent for at least a movie theater, Five Below, and a women's clothing store. According to auction website LoopNet, the 10Z auction listing for the Village Mall states an online auction will occur January 26th through the 28th of the 281,000-square-foot, 10% leased site at 2917 North Vermilion Street. Remaining mall tenants, including Hibbett Sporting Goods, City Trends, and Danville Area Community College's Barber School. The Interior Corridor Mall building was purchased at an auction last year by Jimmy Virk, CEO of California-based Beyond Bancard. Bath & Body Works will be the latest store to leave the Village Mall in Danville later this month, according to Mayor Ricky Williams, Jr. Let's move over to our J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History editorial with the title, From British Stamps to Russian Vodka, A Brief History of Boycotts. After Russia invaded Ukraine a little less than 4 years ago, Americans began saying "nyet" to Russian vodka, expressing their anger over the Kremlin's unprovoked action via government bans and customers pouring it in gutters by the gallon. Politicians have known since the Republic's founding that folks love taking out their frustrations at the ballot box. And in a capitalist economy like ours, Americans aren't shy about doing it with their pocketbooks either. In fact, American independence actually grew out of one of such economic protests. Britain shelled out big bucks, or pounds as it were, on the French and Indian War, which ran from 1754 to 1763. To recoup that money, Parliament imposed the Stamp Act on its American colonies in 1765. Everything from playing cards to magazines to newspapers required the hated tax stamp. And get this, it had to be paid in actual British pounds, not with the colonial's own cheaper paper money. Taxes being every bit as popular then as they are now, the colonials weren't too merry about sending their income back to merry old England. It led to the famous rallying cry, taxation without representation. It also produced an economic boycott. Colonists suddenly found that they could do without new playing cards, magazines, and newspapers. That hurt businesses' bottom line back in Britain, and King George III put the kibosh on the hated tax a year later. When the U.S. entered World War I in 1917, many patriotic people boycotted Germany's signature dish, sauerkraut. Those who couldn't go without the tart treat justified it by rebranding it Liberty Cabbage for the duration. In more recent times, Russia's best-known brand of booze, Stolichnaya Vodka, was also the target of a widespread boycott. On September 1st of 1983, Korean Airlines Flight 007 veered off course and was shot down over Soviet airspace. All 269 people on board, including Georgia Congressman Larry McDonald, were killed. That prompted an immediate and intense pushback from furious American consumers. At its height, 15 state liquor agencies banned Stoli sales, but the bottles were back on most store shelves in less than a year. And in some places, the boycott boomeranged. In Iowa, for example, sales shot up from an average of 34 cases sold before the crisis to 68 afterward. Another Cold War relic, the Cuban trade embargo, didn't go entirely as planned either. The Kennedy administration announced a major extension of existing embargoes to punish the island's communist government. Cutting off exports of legendary Cuban cigars turned them into a highly prized forbidden fruit, relished by stogie connoisseurs. It should also be noted that JFK secretly ordered some, 1,200 of the very cigars, for his personal use just hours before announcing the embargo on February 7th of 1962. Talk about insider trading! A mini backlash against France in general and a famous food item in particular came in 2001. France opened the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. That prompted some eateries, including congressional restaurants on Capitol Hill, to stop selling French fries and start offering freedom fries instead. The crackdown on Russian booze that began in 2022 is part of a proud tradition. When Americans are miffed, they view cash registers at voting booths and their dollars as their ballot. A parting point worth noting, like so many words in our vocabulary, sandwich, cardigan, Braille, and even graham crackers, boycott comes from someone's name. After retiring from the British Army, Captain Charles Boycott worked as a landlord in Ireland. Times were hard on the Emerald Isle in the late 19th century. Tenants demanded their rent be lowered. It came down a little, but not enough to help the impoverished Irishman. Boycott was ordered to evict people in 1880. That didn't go over well in the close-knit Irish community. His employees stopped working for him. Store owners wouldn't take his money, and even his postal carrier refused to deliver his mail. In short, they boycotted Boycott, which was how that proper noun became a verb. And there's a picture here of a passerby looking at a sign posted at a New York City deli on March 18th of 2003, 2 days before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, that announced that French fries were now being called freedom fries in a protest of French opposition to the invasion. And we have time for a little bit more of opinion piece by Jim Dye. Walz's ambitions die hard, but real fraud problem lives on. The demise of a prominent politician often follows the same path as that of a business headed for bankruptcy, slowly and then all at once, as the going says the saying goes. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz can identify with that description because he's the latest example of a one-time high flyer who suddenly crashed and burned. For a fleeting moment, Walz was on the top of a political world, wrote Minnesota Star Tribune. The two-term Minnesota governor was plucked from relative obscurity to run for vice president on the 2024 Democratic Party ticket with Kamala Harris. Introduced to the nation in a wave of friendly publicity, the former teacher, football coach, and U.S. House member was characterized as such a nice, decent guy that he would play the role of America's dad. Who knew that good old Pop was heading a dysfunctional family back in Minnesota that was handing out taxpayer dollars by the bushel to welfare fraudsters? Well, now, that story is the making of nationwide headlines. Walz is history. A few months ago, he announced his plan to seek an unprecedented third term as the state's chief executive, but the drip, drip, drip of his ever-expanding scandal turned him from the toast of the town to just toast. Declining poll numbers and rapidly melting support from national and state Democrats forced Walz's announcement Monday as he's dropping his plans to run again. He will, if new accounts are correct, be replaced as a Democratic gubernatorial candidate by U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. But Walz didn't jump. He was pushed by circumstances and one-time friends. And he's not really at peace with his decision, as one news account stated. Instead, he's reached the fifth stage of political death, acceptance. A guy who once dreamed of being a heartbeat away from the presidency is now just another schmo who acknowledged his accountability, but certainly not to blame for Minnesota mammoth scandal. Feigning acceptance of responsibility is standard politician speak. But Walz is not solely responsible for the unfathomable mess. The problem is institutional. For starters, the amount of money stolen from taxpayers borders on the unfathomable. The investigation has been going on for several years. The story is far from dead. Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Thompson, who already has convicted dozens of participants from the Somali community, said, "Every day we look under a rock and find a new $50 million fraud scheme." He estimates, according to the Washington Post, fraud may be an account for more than half of the $18 billion that went into these programs since 2018. That's $9 billion. $1 billion is $1,000 million. How could this have happened? The only viable explanation is that for an unexplained reason, program managers didn't care who was receiving the federal money being thrown out the nearest window. Here's just one example of the program. The Minnesota Reformer reports that spending on Medicaid autism programs increased 3,000% due to an explosive 700% growth in the number of providers who diagnose and treat people with autism spectrum disorder. They increased from 41 providers in 2018 to 328 last year. And I'm going to have to stop with this article here. We only had a little bit left. But this is the end of our first section of the News Gazette, and I will be back soon to finish the rest.